This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The songwriting team of Holland Dozier Holland helped define the Motown sound. Many of their best-known songs were written for the Supremes and the Four Tops. Songs like Stop in the Name of Love, You Can't Hurry Love, Baby Love, Where Did Our Love Go, Reach Out I'll Be There, Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, Bernadette, and It's the Same Old Song. They also wrote Heatwave, Jimmy Mac, How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, Mickey's Monkey, and Baby Don't You Do It. That's quite a list, and it's by no means complete. Brian Holland and Lamont Dozier wrote the music. Eddie Holland wrote the lyrics. They left the label in 1968. A new box set of their hits, called Heaven Must Have Sent You, has just been released. Terry Gross spoke with them in 2003 when they were set to receive the BMI Icon Award. She asked lyricist Eddie Holland how he worked with the other two members of the songwriting team.
Often when Brian and Lamont would work together on the basic melodies, In the earlier stages, sometimes, you know, one or two of us, you know, or three of us would come up with an idea, and then they would give me, after they recorded the instrumentation in the studio, they would give me that tape of that, and I would have to write the lyric to it.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So the song already had a feel to it. It had a sound before there was a lyric.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Most definitely.
Because we cut tracks first, you know, most of the time. It was done with tracks first, and then once we got the feeling and we gave Eddie a melody to work from, then he would know some idea about what it is that we were feeling, Brian and I, when we sat down to do these things. In this particular case, Reach Out, I'll Be There, Brian came up with that initial da ba da da ba da ba da ba da da. And then it went into the funk part, as I call it, and then that's when I joined in, and we did a lot of things like that in compiling the track, and then once the track had been established, we would share our feelings about the melody, and then after the melody and the idea and whatever title we had, then we would pass it on to Eddie so he could complete the lyrics.
I just find that so interesting because for so many other songwriters, it's the melody and the lyric that come first, and then the production's conceptualized.
You know, funny
you're
thing,
hearing
we,
all these
we
instrumental
never knew
notes
that.
First.
No one ever told us that.
Now, if you feel that you can't go on because all of your hope is gone and your life is filled with much confusion until happiness is dead.
More about how you worked together as a songwriting and production team, how you divided up the responsibilities and what the process was like.
Well, it started off, I guess, with sitting at the piano. This is Lamont. Started off at the piano with coming up with an idea first, or a feeling of sorts. And then once we established that, Brian and I would work out a track that we wanted to cut, or a feeling for a track, and we would go in and cut. Brian was the engineer. We both would put our feelings about the track and the music that we wanted to inject in the track, and relay that to the musicians. Like, say, for instance, I Can't Help Myself. As a bass line that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Then I would pass that on to James Jamison while Brian was over telling Benny Benjamin what the feeling of the drum should be. This was the type of way we the workload, as I say, should that we distribute the workload, and then we pass that on to Eddie with any lyric or idea or title for him to complete the song.
At what point would you know what group was going to sing the song?
Well, this is Eddie Holland speaking. Well, pretty much we directed our attentions as a rule towards a specific group. For an example, if we were working on the Supremes, we would write specifically for the Supremes. If we were doing the Vandellas, we would write specifically for the Vandellas or the Four Tops or whatever. But Brian and Lamont were so very prolific in their coming up with melodies and ideas that very often they would do songs that didn't necessarily fit the particular artists that we were working on, meaning that they would come up with three songs and maybe two of the three or one of the three did not fit that particular artist that we were working towards, working, you know, on to get the production. So that song then would be diverted to another artist.
Can you think of an example like that?
Well, yes. I mean, in the process of coming up with songs for the Supremes, there was a song called This Old Heart of Mine that was later done on the Isley Brothers. And, you know, in the process of also working on, you know, the Supremes and or the Vandellas at that time, mm-hmm. there was a song called Baby, I Need Your Lovin', which later on was given to the Four Tops. So that is the examples of us working on a particular artist and then some of the songs being diverted to someone else.
Let's hear another record. You did a lot of work with the Supremes. Some of the Supremes' hits that you wrote and produced include Where Did Our Love Go?, Baby Love, Come See About Me, Stop in the Name of Love, I Hear a Symphony, My World is Empty Without You, Love is Like an Itching in My Heart, Can't Hurry Love, You Keep Me Hanging On, et cetera, et cetera. So why don't we hear You Can't Hurry Love? Tell us about creating the song and creating the record, and then we'll hear it.
Brian came up with that, I remember. Yeah, it was like a gospel thing, I guess. You can't hurry love. A nice little bounce, and he came up with that idea and that feeling that just... At the time, the Supremes were riding high and filling their oats as superstars and what have you. And so it was like the next process in the scheme of things, meaning that it was a hit song that a lot of artists couldn't have done, you know. But because of their popularity, we could get away with something like that with them, you know. So, again, we cut the track and passed that on to Eddie. I think that was, I don't know, Eddie, he had to come up with a title for that.
I came up with the title for that. I was influenced by, Lamont hit it right on the head, by the way. This is Eddie. I was influenced by, I guess it's safe to say now, how many years has it been? the gospel songs that's what influenced me. But to make it even clearer, what influenced me to be influenced by the gospel song was the melody and the beat of the song itself, the syncopated movement of the melody. influenced me to think of that old gospel song, you know, which I won't really say what it is, but all you gospel people out there, you know what it is.
Oh, what is it? Come on.
I'm not going to say it.
Oh, say it. Say it.
Nah, I'm not going to say it. But they'll know. You know who you are. But through the lyric, even in there, you could tell, you know, it was influenced. But see, because we grew up, Brian and I can't really speak for Lamont on that because I'm not sure. We never talked too much about that. But Brian and I, you know, we grew up in the church at a very, very young age. Matter of fact, the first hearing of Sunday school, or school, period, I thought it was Sunday school. You know, that's the first school I knew was Sunday school that I could retain. You know, that's the truth. So we grew up in the, you know, in a Baptist church, you know, Davison Avenue Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan, there on St. Auburn. You know, a lot of the songs, you know, I was influenced by what influenced me in the church.
I think that was why we got along so well, because we had the same musical upbringing, classical music mixed with gospel music. And in my particular case, I couldn't get out the house unless I go to choir rehearsal with it.
You too. we finally found out. Huh?
Yeah. You know, and that was a must, you know, in the black home in those days. My grandmother was a choir instructor, and I had to be there for choir rehearsals on Thursdays and then all day Sunday, and maybe sometimes on Saturdays, you know, with this choir business. From the time I was 12 years old, learning about harmonies and singing in the choir and things like that. So I learned quite a bit, and I think we all did, because it was like the backbone of most black singers today, from Aretha Franklin, who is a good friend of ours that we knew back there, and a lot of other people that we knew at Motown, exactly, that grew up in church. Marvin Gaye was another church boy, you know, and most of our training came from church. So when you say songwriting is done this way or that way, we just shot from the hip. Whatever felt good, that's what we did.
Well, let's hear one of your many records that turned out great. This is the Supremes' You Can't Hurry Love. Songs have catchphrase titles like You Can't Hurry Love or Reach Out, I'll Be There, Sugar Pie Honey Bun, Nothing But Heartaches, You Keep Me Hanging On. Eddie, you wrote a lot of the lyrics, or all of the lyrics. Is there a reason why those phrases would come to you as song titles?
Well, no. That Sugar Pie Honey Bunch thing was Lamont.
And I got it from my grandfather. he used to call
that. That's for sure.
Yeah, he got that from you know, in the South, they had those catchphrases, being that my grandfather was from the South. He used to come, and we had a, my grandmother had a home shop, a beauty shop, and all the women used to come into the shop, and he'd be working in the front garden, and he sort of would be flirting with them, and he was like, "How you doing, Miss Carrie? Sugar pie, honey bunch," you know, flirting with them. And my grandmother used to be watching from the door, said, look at that old college out there. And the thing is, a lot of the things like that came back to when it came time for me to use some of those catchphrases. Mm-hmm. They came back just when we needed something to say and to fit a certain track or whatever. In this mm-hmm. case, that's what it was.
Yeah, but mostly I would use titles. This is Eddie speaking again. That you know, that had some meaning. You know, I would try to do something titled, use titles that I felt had appeal from an emotional point of view. And a lot of the titles were things that were said to me that I had direct personal experiences in dealing with, you know. You know, I was a young man. And
little sweetheart or two.
You know, so a lot of the, yeah, so a lot of the titles would be actually titles that females, ladies, you know, I would say, nice ladies,
would say
to me. Sometimes out of anger, sometimes out of whatever, you know. So a lot of that, but you could hear something that had feeling, you could hear something that had meaning, and I basically believed in using titles and ideas that had feeling or appealed to them.
Wait, so did you have a girlfriend who said, "You don't really love me, you just keep me hanging on"?
Well, I had a lot of them that said, to say the least. But yeah, that was an argument that I had, you know, with someone that they said that to me, yes.
And you were taking notes.
Yeah. Well, you know what? When you're a creative person, you don't necessarily, it just sticks to you. As soon as you hear it, it catches you right away. And for some reason, all your instincts, you know, you could be in the middle of an argument, or, you know, I've been on telephones and talking to females in different conversations, you know. Sometimes they would say certain things. I'd say, "Well, hold on for a minute," and I would go get me a pencil, and I would write it down, you know, because it's just being a creative person, especially knowing that your responsibility is doing the lyric, and you doing the lyric with two very, very prolific, you know, meaning Brian Lamont, very, very prolific songwriters. You have to constantly, you have to think it and feel it and live it all the time, you know. But yeah, you know, it's a natural thing. I think all songwriters are like that, or poets are like that. You know, they hear something, they jot it down. Either if they don't jot it down, then they take mental notes, and it sticks. You know, I've had titles in my head that I've had for 25 years. I have titles in my head now that I've had for 25 years. That it's just ideas and thoughts. You know, that's it just stick. You just stand out. You know.
How are you meshed with the Supremes? How did the Supremes become one of your groups?
They became our group, so to speak, when we came up with Where'd Our Love Go? And Where'd Our Love Go was something that by accident happened that could have been just as well for the Marvelettes or people like that. But because it was a big hit on the Supremes, in this particular case, the song was so big that Barry came in and said, "Hey, we got to follow this up." And that's when we started doing more baby stuff, baby love, baby this, baby that.
But only thing about it, I talked to Barry Gordy on one night on the porch of Motown. And he said, "Listen," he said, "I talked to Barney. Barney said, Barney Ailes, he's the guy, you know, was heading of sales at that time and handling distributors. He said, the record is a smash, it's a big record. And he says, we need to hurry up and do more on the Supremes and because Motown needs to go all out on making the Supremes a big group." He said, because they have big crossover potential. And so when I heard that, I went back and told Brian Lamont. I said, "Listen, we have to move on this group because the company has the intent of being very strongly behind this group." And so what we have to do is come up with some other songs on the group because, you know, it's a very competitive company here. And so we did that. And I don't know whether they remember, once I came in there and I told them that nobody was leaving out of here. I don't know if they remember that. No. I closed the office door, and they said they're going. They were leaving. I said, no, man, nobody's leaving out of this office. We coming up with some songs. Lamont looked at me, Brian looked. And then so the fact of the matter is the next three, number one or top ten or whatever the songs that I don't recall now, was done that day.
That's right.
And Brian and I got into an argument, what should be the next follow-up or what should be this follow-up. That's the only argument. All three of those songs were done that day on the next session.
Which songs were they?
Baby Love and Come See About Me.
Right. And it was another one,
it's too.
It was another one, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Baby Love, Come See About Me. And then
got him back in my arms.
It was something else that was, yeah. But whatever, maybe it was just the two. I thought it was three. But if those two songs was done on the same session,
yeah,
when they were recorded that day, and then, like I said, Brian and I got into an argument. He and I argued a lot. Lamont sort of looked and eased his way out. Out of the office. He was always very smart not to get involved.
Two brothers arguing.
You know, he just say, "Hey, whoever wins, I'm on your side." You know, he's a real politician.
Brian Holland, you were vice president for quality control at Motown. What did that mean?
That meant that I would take the records. I mean, the records that are being mixed, I would take them and listen to them and see, did it have the quality to go out on the street?
Mm-hmm.
And if it was not the quality I thought it should be, or I thought Berry Gordy would want, then I would reject it and have it redone again.
Not the greatest way of making friends. Did you get into a lot of fights?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I remember specifically... I got into not a fight, you know what I mean? We got a disagreement with a couple of producers because I turned down whatever thing they thought was hits and said no, it wasn't good enough to go out.
Did you have other ways of testing it? You know, were there meetings in which you played it for everybody else at Motown, or were there dances that you could test a record before it was released commercially to see if it was infectious or not?
Yeah, well, this is Brian again, as you know. What had happened is that we had what they call a quality control meeting, and to listen to all the records that were scheduled to go out, and we would vote on them. We have about maybe 8 to 10 people that would actually vote on a record, and if they say yay, the majority say yay, then it goes out.
And
Personally, I always, this is Eddie, personally, I always thought it was more of a popularity contest more than anything, because nobody was going to say no on Smokey Robinson's songs for the most part, or Berry Gordy's either,
I remember, too, every once, and this is Lamont, every once in a while, we had some kids come in the big studio. Well, big studio wasn't a big studio, but in the main studio that we recorded, and we would have chips, Coke and chips, Coca-Cola that is, and chips, and had the kids come in. I remember one summer we did that. We had an onslaught of songs and. I think Mickey Stevenson had sort of got some kids together off the street or whatever and brought them into the studio. And we had a little a reviewing party, a song party, whatever you want to call it, a listening party. And they played these songs, and a lot of the kids would express their opinion on what they felt. They danced to the songs and gave opinions on them and made little cards and jot down what they liked.
Did you ever disagree with them and think, oh, what do you know anyways? You're just a kid. I'm a professional songwriter, and I know better.
Well, this is Brian speaking. We did that. He's right. We did it on several occasions, but it proved not to be good.
Okay.
For one, Smokey Robinson, he and Berry used to get into it all the time about his records, and he would demand that Berry bring in a whole bunch of kids, and to test his records out. And the kids, Smoker was so popular that they said, yeah. And they put the record out, and they flopped. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a good, that proved not to be a good choice. The older people, the more, I would say the 25 to 30 to 40 people we had in the quality control meetings proved to be the most accurate of releasing records.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they were both reliable because they got into the song, got into the feeling of the situation, and the lyric, and just the overall production. Then there were times when Barry would just override everything. When everybody said, no, it was a flop or whatever they thought. And he would say, well, I'm putting this out anyway, or I'm not putting it out. Now, he would override the whole situation at times.
What's the biggest disagreement you had in-house with Barry Gordy or other people in quality control over whether one of your records was good enough?
Well, I don't think we had, but I know Smokey, Brian, you were talking about, you really got a hold on me. Barry didn't think that was so great.
Great record.
Well, none of us thought that was great. No. We were trying to figure out what had happened, in the studio with Smokey, and Smokey just said, no, this is a top 10, and he was right. He proved it.
Did you change your mind, or do you still think it's mediocre?
No comment.
But also, Edward, we had a Smokey had a disagreement with one of our records.
Reach out,
I'll be there.
Smokey, he didn't like it. This is Eddie, mm-hmm. And I was in the quality control meeting that particular day. I remember that Smokey. I looked at him, and he said, "Well, I don't like the record. It's kind of." I don't hear it. It's kind of a strange kind of record. And then we went, and I remember, and then Barry looked and asked a couple other people. Nobody could get into that Reach Out, I'll Be There.
Hmm.
And Barry looked. He said, well, all I know is that it's unique, and I never heard a record like this. And so he, being a creative person, I think he gambled on. Knowing was a little odd, sounded a little odd. But I think what he did was gamble on the fact of the creativity he thought was astounding. And then, to make matters worse, I still kind of held that in the back of my mind when I heard, watch that. We went into the studio to dub in the Four Tops. And the individual that handled their harmonies, what was his name?
Lawrence
Payton. He listened to it, and I said, what do you think? He said, it's a little strange. That was his comment. So I figured that was another way of him being politely saying, I don't like it.
It turned out great. One of the things that I think makes it distinctive and might have also made it sound strange is the huh. Yeah. I sound silly when I do that, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, you sounded pretty good. That's right.
So who came up with that?
That was something
collaborated.
Yeah, this type of thing that we all just sort of agreed on. I was in the studio, Lisa Lamont, with the guys, and we were thinking about different ways to fill in, because the song was different and the way it moved and going from one section to another. There are certain spots you wanted to enhance the feeling of the song. Mm-hmm. So you put in, certain things like that that we had to do to sort of add to the feeling of the song to give it more of a oomph, you know.
Well, we'd have time just to end with one more recording, and I thought we'd play the Martha and the Vandellas hit Heat Wave, which you wrote and produced. Brian, is there a story behind the song?
Well, it was a successful song. That's the main story, but not much of a story other than we had fun doing that song, and it took a lot of editing work I had to do on that song.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Right.
A lot of tape on the floor.
What kind of editing?
Well, just like when you're going to edit this tape, I guess, maybe to some degree. But you had to take out little parts that you didn't need, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And to make the song whole.
Yeah.
Okay.
to keep the intensity, the energy, right, and the intensity
right, going.
Yeah,
right.
Right. You have to do that sometimes. Sometimes a lot of lull in the song, you know,
right.
meaning that it a lot of wasted air, time, or maybe. And then you only had, in those days, like 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes long in those days. So you had to make sure that you hit all the hot spots and keep the energy up.
It was a very high energy song.
Oh yeah. It was that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And a big hit for them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for us, too.
Well, listen, congratulations on your BMI Award. Thank you so much for talking with us. It was really fun. And thanks for all the great music you've given us.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Eric. It's been a pleasure.
That's Heatwave, performed by Martha and the Vandellas and written by our guests Brian Holland, Lamont Dozier, and Eddie Holland. Terry Gross spoke with the songwriters in 2003, shortly before they were to receive the BMI Icon Award. A box set compilation of their Motown hits is now available. It's called Heaven Must Have Sent You.